We have a very special guest on the line today, Michael Mead. Welcome, Michael. Are you there?
Yes. Good morning, Mike.
How are you?
Pretty good. How's it going in Portland?
Good. Going well. You're going to be coming to Portland this Friday, October 23rd, and Saturday the 24th at the Unitarian Church. Could you give us a little info on what you're going to be doing?
Well, Friday night is an evening called The Light Inside Dark Times. And so I'm taking, you know, the notion that we're living through the dark times now, whether you look at nature or look at culture, you know, climate change and pretty much the unraveling of culture, and whether you're looking at the choices between having flu shots and for which flu, or how do you handle the economic crisis, whatever aspect of life you turn to nowadays, there's concern, there's threat, there's even danger. And I'm taking the notion that when everything gets dark and troubling, it's really the soul that we need. There's an old phrase that says that the soul is the light hidden inside the darkness. So I make a distinction between, for instance, soul and spirit, or soul and things of the mind, because soul has to do with the depths of life, but it also has to do with our connections to the world, to the earth. When people are talking about environmental issues, the soul becomes a key thing because it's through the soul that we connect to the earth, but also through the soul we connect to other people. And so it's really the essence of community as well. So I'm talking about how to hold on to the sense of community, the sense of meaning in one's own life, amidst everything that's going on, and I'm using the soul as the symbol and as the connective tissue for these times.
What's the difference between spirit and soul? Is there a difference there?
Yeah. Spirit traditionally is connected to fire and air, and it goes up. So everything that has ascension in it, climbing in it, everything from going up the social ladder to spiritually ascending towards heaven all have to do with spirit. And that includes things like being at the top of the heap. So the American culture is very spirit-oriented. I don't mean that it's spiritual, not really, but typically it's not. But it's very spirit-oriented, or it's involved with ascendancy. And that's one reason everybody's having so much trouble with the big downturn that's going on now. Mm-hmm. Soul is connected to earth and water, and it moves downwards. So soul connects us down into the solidity of the earth, but also into the darkness that's below, which can be the underworld or even the inner parts of the earth. But it's important to remember that in going down, for instance, in penetrating the earth, that's where you find the gems, and in particular, the gold. And so there's a deeper gold standard that has to do with inner gold. And so that's the part that I'm talking about, how to find inner gold when the outer gold standard is unstable and threatened.
Mm-hmm. Your latest book is called The World Behind the World, Living at the Ends of Time. And one of my favorite chapters and one of my favorite stories is called Running Towards the Roar. Can you explain this story to us a little bit?
Yeah, this is an old fable told in Africa, and it's typically told by the elders to the youth. And it's kind of an education about the world. And what they say is that when the lions are hunting the gazelles, let's say, they take the old lions who have maybe a few teeth left, but really can't bite into anything, but they still have the capacity to roar, and they put them on one side of the plain. And then the healthy lions go to the opposite side and hide. So then here comes the herd of gazelles, you know, dancing down through the plain, and the old toothless or barely have a few teeth lions roar at the gazelles, who then in fear turn and run the other way, and they run right into the healthy lions waiting for the meal to be delivered. And when they tell the story, what they're advising people is run towards the roar. Mm-hmm. Run towards the thing that seems the most scary and we'll find a way through. So the big roar nowadays, there's lots of things roaring. That through climate change, global warming, the world might end. Or other people are going by the idea that by 2012, the world will end. Or the Christians might come to believe that God will bring the world to an end. And what the old tale would say, run towards that roaring thing that seems to be the end, and you'll find a way through and possibly find the threads of new beginnings.
Mm-hmm. Now, you do a lot of work with disadvantaged youth and prison populations, and you mentioned in your book, our youth and our elders can actually help us turn things around. Could you explain how this is related?
Well, youth and elders are the two groups that don't fit into culture very readily. The youth, because they're trying to find their way and they have to get in trouble to find it, but also the youth because they have a dream of life that's going to live past the lives of those who are in charge. So youth are carrying a vision of the future that doesn't fit in easily to the common presence. And then the elders are supposed to be over the hill and out of the way. But it turns out that the elders actually have the capacity to imagine the world continuing for a long time. Native Americans say, make your decisions based on stuff that will be important seven generations down the line. Imagine if Congress did that while thinking about health care.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens typically when a culture is in trouble, the youth get rejected, the elders get forgotten, and therefore begin to forget themselves. And so in these critical times, it's important to invite the youth who have a vitality and a dream that might outlive us, and also to awaken the elders inside the olders. There's more old folks in the culture than any other age group, but they're simply getting older and not necessarily getting wiser. And somehow, I think, there needs to be an awakening of the elder inside the olders.
Right. Can you explain a little bit more about what the difference is between growing old and becoming an elder? Is there a process there, do you see? Or?
Well, growing old is a biological fact. Everybody, even as we're speaking, is actually getting older. And then inside that biological fact is a thing that's very scary to modern Americans, which is the additional fact that everyone is going to die. From the moment that we're born, we're walking towards our death. But the elder is something that awakens inside a person when they begin to extract knowledge and wisdom from the struggles of their own lives. So the elders are not those who have been too good or too perfect not to fall down. They're the ones who have fallen down and then found from that falling down how to get up and be stronger, so that in a crisis in traditional cultures, people turn to the elders, not necessarily to a committee in Congress. So what's going on now is we have a lack of elders exactly at a time when we need wisdom rather than more information and knowledge. And so I'm telling stories, and I will be on Friday night, about the return or the awakening of the elders, which can only happen in terms of traditional stories in conjunction with the youth. One reason I work with youth in trouble, I work with prisoners, I work with veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, I work with all kinds of people in trouble, because it's in trouble that we find our inner wisdom and our hidden resources. And so the quickest way to get or to be with people who are truly awake is to find people who have either lived through trouble and awakened or are in trouble right now. Culturally, we are in a troubled condition, but also close to a possible awakening.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that it's important to avoid cynicism and naivete. Could you talk about this a little bit?
Well, the current times are overwhelming to almost everybody. You know, wherever you turn, you hit these troubles coming from all directions. And so two of the big defenses are cynicism. Oh, it doesn't mean anything. Or reductionism, where everything is reduced to something. It doesn't really matter. Someone finds something amazing or interesting about life, they tell someone else, and the other person says, that doesn't mean much. Or that's just your opinion. So that's a kind of a cynicism that is self-protecting, but it produces an internal bitterness, and it eventually robs a person of their vitality. The opposite direction for common protection is naivete, thinking I'm the exception to the rule, or like the far extreme Christians are waiting for the rapture. They're not worried about the condition of the world or apparently their own grandchildren because they're waiting for the rapture. I call that naivete. I'd rather stand with Van Morrison, who says, give me my rapture today. In other words, the naive wait for something that never comes instead of turning to the difficulty but the hidden beauty of life and finding something meaningful now.
Why do you think we are, as a culture and maybe individually, why are we so afraid of this descent into these dark times or this darkness? What do you think is going on there?
Well, some of it has to do with this fascination with the mind and the sense of spirit uplifting everything. And another factor is the stories that are most commonly told consider falling to be a mistake or to be a failure. You know, life is about failure. So is sports. So is writing. So is dancing, for goodness sake. So we have been sold a false bill of goods that the economy has to always rise, that the cream will rise to the top. Look at the last administration. The dregs rose to the top. So we have the wrong, or at least, I would say, distorted stories about the world. Once you start to pay attention to darkness, you can find all kinds of things. Like one of the old definitions of wisdom was dark knowledge. Wisdom is actually a knowledge that knows how to handle both light and dark. We're still living in a kind of self-inflated culture that thinks that whiteness and brightness is really superior to darkness. But if you go to the traditional cultures, you find the Tai Chi symbol, which shows that light and dark need to be balanced. Mm-hmm. All the creation myths are about beauty and life coming out of darkness. And strangely enough, modern physicists have now determined that the universe is 96% dark matter and dark energy. We're actually floating on an island of light in the middle of eternal darkness. And if those kind of big ideas, mythical ideas, were more common, people would be less afraid of the dark and learn how to live with a kind of braille, a kind of feeling our way through the darkness. And that allows the possibility of creation and renewal right there from the dark. The kind of collapse of certain things inside of American culture is also the kind of preparing of the ground for, I think, a possible greater awakening that values the individual as well as the community and the surround of nature.
Yes, you mentioned that the higher elements, like such as gold, can be found in these lowly places. How can we learn the art of bending down into these realms in our everyday lives and you know, feel some of this gold, I guess you could call it?
Well, it's interesting. America has, as a culture, and this is the water we all still drink, has been working on the notion that comfort is better than difficulty or struggle, on the notion that there's a way to be above it all. And it turns out that there's more intrigue with getting caught in things. In the World Behind the World book, I have a chapter called Finding the Right Trouble. The soul likes trouble because trouble is what brings things from the depths up to the surface. So one of the tricks is to get into the right trouble. And so the right trouble for one person could be hospice work. A lot of us would find that a very fearful thing, but some people are drawn to it because they have a capacity to stand at the threshold between life and death and help others across the threshold. For another person, the right trouble is how to purify or cleanse water systems. For another person, they have an intrigue with the homeless. Their way of finding home is to work with the homeless. So there's a surprising thing that happens. If people would go to the trouble that intrigues them, to the marginal area of life that they're attracted to, they might find more vitality, less fear, and more intrigue and more capacity to help others and thereby help themselves. So another way to go after that gold is to look for the right trouble.
Mm. For those that just tuned in, we are speaking with Michael Mead, who will be in Portland this Friday and Saturday, October 23rd and 24th. Could you tell us what your contact info, Michael, for people that are interested in getting tickets?
Everything can be found out, and tickets can be gathered from www.mosaicvoices.org. That's the Mosaic website. Mosaic is the organization through which we do youth work and work with various kinds of marginalized and at-risk populations. www.mosaicvoices.org.
You mentioned that you like studying physics, and you said that up to 95% of creation is dark matter, which can't even be measured. But I was curious to note that 90% of our DNA is also called junk DNA. I noticed that you like to use singing and music a lot in your events. Do you think there's any correlation or relationship with this at all, this mystery that we can't really quite understand?
Well, yeah, we are ourselves a walking mystery. The old notion is that each individual is a microcosm, a reflection of the great cosmos. So if the cosmos is 96% unknown, then we are also 96% unknown, as the DNA idea kind of supports.
Mm-hmm.
So all knowledge is found at the edge of what we know. So the unknown is actually the source of all knowledge. And one of the things that people know less about than I think is healthy in modern culture is how to connect and engage and kind of stir the mind as well as the body through things like singing. Singing, they found out, I love modern science, even though it's often dissociated from the old ideas of the cosmos, they keep discovering interesting things. They've now discovered from watching the brain operate that the brain, when it's really thinking, as opposed to just having internal dialogue and repeating things, but when creative thinking occurs, the brain cells move in a rhythm.
Mm.
So rhythm is essential to moving things. And when people sing together, you can get this kind of rhythmic imagination that gets going. And then that takes us back to the soul, because an old statement was, the soul is the source of all rhythm. So in chaotic times that we live in now, one of the things that will help people through the troubles is to have a sense of their own rhythm. The rhythm will keep the brain in the a healthy capacity for thinking, but it also keeps the soul connected. So another way to live through trouble is to find one's own rhythm.
Could you speak a little bit about finding our rhythm, and does this relate to imaginal states of being, do you think?
Well, imagination, genuine imagination, is often what's missing. Like right now, you know, the Senate can't imagine how even to talk about health care. All they can do is argue about insurance. So there's a loss of imagination there. Imagination could open up whole other areas of conversation and thought. So imagination is, to me, is the thing that connects the what we call the real world, the world of facts and figures and the world of the earth and gravity, to the spiritual world or the unseen world. Imagination, they used to say, is the deepest sense and gift of human life. Humans are the ones capable of imagining. And so when we're in the right rhythm, not only does the brain get better organized, but imagination becomes a greater possibility. Imagination, the origin of the word, has two things in it, ideas and images. So when we're imagining, we're getting ideas, which most people connect to the brain, but we're getting images, which traditional cultures connect to the heart. And as they used to say, if you can connect the mind and the heart, then you'll be fully awake and fully creative.
Right. One thing that I really found interesting in your book is the possibility that the heart can rise above the head. Could you get into this a little bit?
Yeah, this is a strange thing that pops up in so many cultures. And as you said that, I just remembered one time I was with a group of people and we had just dealt with a lot of conflict. And I said, okay, I think now that we have done that, we should honor the situation and respect each other. So let's all bow. So we all bowed. And it was beautiful and it felt right. And then an Asian, I think maybe Chinese woman in the group came up to me on the break and said, you know, that wasn't really a full bow. Would you like to learn how to bow? And I said, yeah. So she taught me this notion that real bowing is bending so far over that the heart winds up above the head.
Oh, my goodness.
And that's the nature of the bow. Mm-hmm. So the heart is able to bow down to nature, the beauty of nature. It's able to bow to ideas that are new or foreign to us. It's able to bow to the other, as they say. Whereas the head and the mind tends to be more firmly connected to the ego, which has trouble bowing because it's so busy trying to protect.
Right. You also mentioned that the afflicted are holy. I found that fascinating. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, that's another old notion that I find really valuable. It's more common in the modern world for people to think that when you have no affliction, you have no trouble, then you're okay, and actually you might even be better than everybody. But holiness, which is connected to the word whole, and health, they all come from the same root. Holiness has to do with handling affliction in the best way. For instance, thinking about the United States, supposedly the most powerful country in the world. Well, from a point of view of affliction, you would say the value of a culture is demonstrated by how it handles those who are suffering the most, those who are afflicted. So now we watch as those who have a lot of good health care, supposedly at least good insurance and all, are trying to deny it to others as if the affliction of life isn't the actual most common shared human experience, and as if health wouldn't be the most obvious way for a culture to nourish and care for its own people. In the attention to affliction is the only place where healing occurs. Affliction is the necessary precondition for the capacity to healing, for healing to grow.
It's kind of like a wound is a womb, as you mentioned.
Yeah, the again, everybody tries to come out of these things perfect when to be human is to be wounded. That's what we share in common, our various wounds. And healing is only done with the assistance of what they call the archetype of the wounded healer. Our wounds are the womb from which we can grow and learn to heal. So the wounds that are hitting America now, the financial collapse, the collapse of the, you know, the notions about bringing democracy to the world and all that kind of stuff. That brokenness, that wound, that collapse is actually the material from which healing and making whole could come again if people would just bow to the current circumstances and accept it and go back to working together.
Could you also talk a little bit about the erotic nature of the soul and how that fits in?
Well, this is something I've been, as I've gotten older, I've learned more and more about, I'm happy to say. Eros is the old Greek word for everything that attracts and connects. Eros is the first god, they say, or the first deity born after creation begins. Eros is the stickiness of life, the glue of life. It's the essence of love and all the attractions between people. And right now, what's going on in the culture is major fragmentation and dissociations of all kinds. I mean, the extremes of politics are being danced out, and things are getting more extreme, and I imagine they're going to get extreme even to a greater degree. In the midst of all that, one of the few things that can make us feel still connected both to ourselves and to culture and to nature is eros. That is to say, following our instinctive natural things we love. Some people love to be in water, and that's a big eros for them. Other people would rather climb to the mountain to get a beautiful view. That's eros for them. They also have found, on the level of personal eros, that as the economy went down, the amount of lovemaking inside the culture has also gone down. There's a depletion of making love or being erotic with other people inside the culture. So it seems to me that that's an awful good practice to pick up and work on, how to become more erotic. And I would just mention, in case any of the folks listening are a little bit older, the elders are supposed to be the best at working with and expressing and feeling eros, and they're supposed to become the teachers about eros. When a person becomes older, they begin to slow down, and eros, as they used to say, likes a slow hand.
We've only got a couple minutes left. We want to mention that you're going to be coming to town this Friday, October 23rd, and Saturday, October 24th, at the Unitarian Church. Could you give out your contact info again, Michael, for people that want to join you?
So the website is www.mosaicvoices.org, and there's a toll-free phone number, which would be 800-233-6984. Mosaic Voices, that's the organization for which we work.
Michael, we want to say thank you so much for joining us today. We look forward to your visit to Portland. You're always a treasure to have come through town. And thank you so much. We'll see you on Friday.
Thanks a lot, Mike. Take good care.
You too. Bye. This is Mike Hoffman for KBOO Radio. Thanks for listening.